from feature story news in Washington and our bureaus around the world. This is FSN Reports. I'm Simon Marks. Today, the story of Sergei Magnitsky, a Russian attorney whose death in a Moscow jail in 2009 remains a substantial bone of contention between Washington and Moscow.
And this is a regular guy who went to his office, sat in his cubicle, had his Starbucks in the morning. He's pulled out of that life, put into the worst hellhole you could ever imagine, and then slowly tortured to death.
On this special edition of the program, we'll hear from the man who hired Sergei Magnitsky to be his attorney, and who has spent the intervening years battling for justice in the case.
These people have threatened me on a number of occasions. They made death threats, and maybe one day they'll get me.
William Browder on Russia and why there are limits to how far Europe will go over Ukraine on this special edition of FSN Reports after the day's main news.
From Feature Story News in Washington, I'm Lorna Shaddick. Ukrainian troops have launched an attack to regain control of an airport in Donetsk, which was taken over by pro-Russian separatists. The assault saw a fierce battle using fighter jets, helicopters and artillery, and comes a day after Ukraine's presidential election, though rebels largely prevented the vote taking place in the east of the country. Daria Bondarchuk reports.
Ukrainian troops have been policing the perimeter of Donetsk airport, where services had been disrupted from Monday morning. But the head of the airport's press service says dozens of armed pro-Russian gunmen from the self-proclaimed Donetsk People's Republic had arrived in the early hours of the morning and demanded the Ukrainian troops to leave. The Reuters news agency reports that the road to the airport is blocked by Ukrainian police. Russian media quotes local witnesses saying several military airplanes and helicopters were spotted in the skies over Donetsk. Daria Bondarchuk, Moscow.
Despite the unrest in the east, Ukrainians elected a new president on Sunday. 48-year-old pro-European billionaire Petro Poroshenko says he'll push for new parliamentary elections and wants to hold talks with Russia to end the crisis. Moscow says it is open to dialogue, but Ukraine's military action against separatists must end. Here's Tom Barton in Moscow.
Mr. Poroshenko, reportedly Ukraine's ninth richest man with a fortune built on chocolate factories, says that talks will be held with those that don't take up arms in the east. He also says that for Ukraine's security, relations should be improved with Russia, as well as taking Ukraine closer to the EU. But he stressed that Kiev would never recognise Russia's occupation of Crimea, which was annexed by Russia in March. Russian President Vladimir Putin said on Friday that he would recognise the result of the election. Tom Barton, Moscow.
A political earthquake. That's how France's Prime Minister has described the results of this weekend's European parliamentary elections. Eurosceptic and far-right parties performed strongly, and the three big centrist blocs all lost seats, though they still hold the parliamentary majority. The United Kingdom Independence Party, or UKIP, took 27% of the British vote, leading Prime Minister David Cameron to say voters were disillusioned with the EU. Dan Whitehead reports from London.
The leader of the United Kingdom Independence Party, Nigel Farage, had predicted a political earthquake, and it was certainly delivered. The party snatched seats from all major political parties, so far seeing 23 members elected to the European Parliament. That's 10 more than they got last year, with the Conservatives, Labour and Liberal Democrats coming in behind. Reacting to his party's win, leader Nigel Farage said his dream had become reality and that UKIP is now the third force in British politics. UKIP's anti-immigration and Eurosceptic view echoes results seen across parts of Europe, where far-right parties also did well. Dan Whitehead, London.
From bureaus worldwide, this is FSN. Voters across Egypt are going to the polls on Monday and Tuesday to choose a new president for the second time in 2 years. The ballots taking place amid tight police and military security operations for fear of attacks by militants. Former army chief Abdel Fattah al-Sisi, who deposed Islamist president Mohamed Morsi last year, is forecast to win the vote. He's standing against left-wing candidate Hamdine Sabahi. Narendra Modi has been sworn in as India's new prime minister during a ceremony at Delhi's presidential palace. The former tea vendor led his BJP party to the biggest victory by any group in India for 30 years, winning a parliamentary majority. The US-India relationship has been on rocky territory recently, but Anish Goel, a senior fellow at the New America Foundation's International Security Programme, says India's new leadership now needs to make an effort to move forward.
I think they need to give the United States some sign, some signal that they're interested also in a strong relationship, something substantive, particularly on the economic and trade and investment side. There are a number of reforms that the Indian government just hasn't moved on in the past couple of years. And I think with a strong mandate, having the Indian government do something to this effect to demonstrate that they are interested in having a relationship, I think that will be very well received in the United States.
U.S. drugs company Pfizer has abandoned its effort to buy British rival AstraZeneca for $117 billion. The deal would have been the drugs industry's biggest ever. The decision ends a month-long public fight between two of the world's biggest pharmaceutical firms that sparked political concerns on both sides of the Atlantic. Sounds there from Arlington National Cemetery just outside Washington, D.C., where fresh from a surprise visit to U.S. troops in Afghanistan this weekend, President Obama has been laying a wreath to mark Memorial Day. It comes amid allegations of delayed medical care and falsified records by the U.S. Department of Veterans Affairs. And that's the latest Feature Story News. Lorna Shaddick reporting.
From Feature Story News in Washington, I'm Simon Marks. Welcome to FSN Reports. On today's programme, an extended interview about Russia with a man who has experienced the dark side of Vladimir Putin's rule. William Browder was, until 7 years ago, a US businessman investing in Russia. Attracted by the opportunity there at the end of the Cold War, in 1996 he founded Hermitage Capital Management, an investment firm named after the famed art museum in Russia's second city, St. Petersburg. He soon parlayed an initial investment of $25 million into holdings worth more than $400 million, and he went on to become one of the biggest foreign investors in the country. Then everything went wrong. In 2006, after a decade of doing business in Russia, he was officially declared a threat to national security after publicly complaining about the corruption he'd encountered. To defend himself and protect his business, he hired an attorney named Sergei Magnitsky. If the name sounds familiar, it should be. Mr. Magnitsky died in 2009 in Russian custody, a death that the US has branded a murder. Congress passed the Magnitsky Act, a law that enforces US sanctions against Russian officials deemed responsible for the attorney's death. Today, as Washington enforces further sanctions against Russia to punish it for its aggression towards Ukraine, Bill Browder offers a unique perspective of the regime that Washington is up against in Moscow. In this extended interview, he spoke to James O'Brien of Britain's LBC Radio.
Sergei Magnitsky was my lawyer. He uncovered a massive Russian government corruption scheme. He testified against the Russian officials involved in the scheme, a bunch of police officers and tax officials. And then some of the same police officers he testified against came to his home a month later in front of his wife and two children, arrested him, put him in pretrial detention. And then they tortured him to try to get him to withdraw his testimony against these officials. They put him in cells with 14 inmates and 8 beds and left lights on 24 hours a day to sleep deprive him. They put him in a cell with no heat and no window panes in December in Moscow, so he nearly froze to death. They put him in a cell with no toilet, just a hole in the floor where the sewage would bubble up. And after about 6 months of this, he got really sick. He lost about 20 kilos. He got really terrible pains in his stomach, and he was diagnosed as having pancreatitis and needing an operation. 1 week before his operation, his scheduled operation, they came and moved him to a prison with no medical facilities. At that point, his health completely broke down. He wrote more than 20 different requests begging for medical attention. They refused all of them. And then he finally, after 3 months of untreated pancreatitis, which, by the way, is one of the most painful things that could ever happen to anybody, he finally went into critical condition. Only then did they allow him to be moved to a prison that had a medical facility. But when he arrived at the new prison with the medical facility, they didn't put him in the emergency room. They took him to an isolation cell, chained him to a bed, and then 8 riot guards with rubber batons beat him for 1 hour and 18 minutes until he died. That was November 16th, 2009. I got the call the very next morning on the 17th of November at about 7:45 in the morning. it was like a knife going right into my heart. I can't even describe to you how awful it was to hear that a man who was my lawyer, who was trying to help me, was taken out of his normal life. And this was a regular guy who went to his office, sat in his cubicle, had a Starbucks in the morning. He was pulled out of that life, put into the worst hellhole you could ever imagine, and then slowly tortured to death. And I feel a huge burden on my shoulder to make sure that we get some justice for this. And we've failed entirely inside Russia. Putin has entered into the fray and protected every single person involved.
Which makes you rather less surprised than most people in this country by recent events on the more international stage. Let me take you back a little further, if I may. Most of us don't have a lawyer in Moscow, so you were clearly commercially involved, and there seems to be a history, an unattractive history of people having commercial involvement in Russian matters, and then, with the benefit of hindsight perhaps, regretting their involvement in Russian commercial matters.
My story goes back quite a long way. My grandfather was an American labor union organizer who was invited by the communists to come to Russia in the late 1920s. He went there, married my grandmother, who's Russian. And my father was born in Moscow, and then they all came back to America, and my grandfather then headed the American Communist Party for the next 13 years. So quite a dramatic and colorful family background, and I ended up, I was born in 1964, and when I was going through my teenage rebellion, I said to myself, what's the best way of rebelling from a family of communists? And so I put on a suit and tie and became a capitalist. And I went to Stanford Business School and graduated the year in 1989, which is the year the Berlin Wall came down. And I said to myself, as I was searching my soul to figure out my career, I said, well, my grandfather was the biggest communist in America. I'm going to try to become the biggest capitalist in Eastern Europe. And I went out to, I moved to London in 89, and then I eventually moved to Moscow in 1996, and I set up an investment fund to invest in Russian companies in the stock market. And my fund took off very dramatically and went from nothing to become the largest investment fund in the country. In the process, we discovered that all the companies we were investing in were basically corrupt. You owned a share of a company, but you owned a share of nothing, really, because the guys who were running these companies were stealing huge amounts of money. And we're not talking about, you know, guys padding their expenses or something like that. We're talking about people stealing billions of dollars of money. And so I decided to do something which proved to be very bad for me, which was we started to expose the corruption in big companies like Gazprom, the national gas company out there, and some of the other big companies. And we would do research on how they did the stealing, and then we would publish the research share the research with the Financial Times, the Wall Street Journal, and various publications. And for a while, it was a very profitable strategy that you expose the bad guys. It was too shameful for them to carry on. And if less money is being stolen, the share price goes up, and the share prices went up a lot. We made a lot of money for our investors. But as you can imagine, the guys who were stealing the money weren't too happy about that.
What about the question of how clean the money you were making was? Just in terms of, I mean, to coin a phrase, if you lie down with dogs, you get fleas.
Well, we had the one type of business that you could have entirely clean, which was you buy shares on the stock market like you do in anywhere. And then you do the research into how those companies are doing bad business, and then you expose their badness. And so, if anything, we were the ones cleaning up the country. It was actually a very gratifying business. That made it very easy to recruit some of the best Russians, because most of the Russian people didn't want to go and be involved in corruption. And we were one of the few businesses where you could actually make some money and be involved in doing good as opposed to doing corruption. So it was really a sort of blessed life until the moment it wasn't.
And you were making a lot of enemies, which explains that moment.
We were making a lot of enemies, and the moment finally came in November of 2005. I'd lived there for 10 years. I was managing the largest investment pool in the country. I thought I was actually sort of doing good for the country, and I thought they recognized that by cleaning up corruption in the companies that we were investing in. And
that sounds a bit naive.
It might sound naive, but I was being welcomed into the halls of power. You know, the ministers and the government and the prime minister were taking meetings with me. They were hearing my briefings. They were feigning interest in my corruption exposés. And so, in retrospect, it sounds naive, and it was. But at the time, it didn't. Anyways, I was flying back to Russia on November 13th, 2005, and they stopped me at the passport control, They then led me down to the bowels of the airport and locked me up in the detention area for 15 hours. And then they shoved me onto an Arafat flight the next morning back to London and declared me a threat to national security.
Wow. I mean, that is about as stark an illustration as it's possible to get of institutional corruption, institutionalized corruption. You were outing oligarchs, if you will, billionaires, and you, as a result, became persona non grata yourself.
I became persona non grata, and so my story tells you everything about Russia. It tells you about high-level corruption, about stealing at the biggest companies, about the cover-up of the stealing of the government, and then tells you about the lengths that they'll go to keep the situation quiet, that they'll arrest a young lawyer, Sergei Magnitsky. My lawyer was 37 years old when he died. They arrest him, arrest a whistleblower. They put him in prison. They torture him. They kill him. And then, as you mentioned at the beginning of the conversation, when we started to get progress in terms of getting sanctions imposed on Russia, which is what we've done since they killed Sergei, they retaliated by putting Sergei on trial 3 years after he died. Even during Stalin, they never tried a dead person. And this is the first trial against a dead man in the history of Russia. They tried him and convicted him, and they convicted me as his co-conspirator and sentenced me to 9 years in Russian prison in absentia. This is the country we have. And Putin, when he was questioned on all this stuff, he basically stood up and said nothing was wrong with our people, these bad Westerners, Bill Browder is a crook, et cetera, et cetera. And so we got a firsthand look of what they're doing now in Ukraine.
Which we will move on to imminently. But I just wonder if you'd address someone listening to this thinking it's too fanciful, what you say. Because there is... Perhaps an understandable skepticism when confronted with such abject, absurd corruption. That some people will go, no, it can't have been that. I mean, to put someone dead on trial, to literally lock someone up simply because he's discovered corruption? I mean, we sit here in the West talking about moral relativism and how we don't understand how threatened Russia feels by NATO. How do you respond to that kind of narrative?
Well, the thing about this story and the reason why it's such an important story to tell is the facts speak for themselves. Mm. They're stark facts. It's all documented. It's all independently documented by totally objective, non-interested observers. This is what Russia is. And most people, when I was telling this story in let's say 6 months ago, a year ago, 2 years ago, in the halls of power and in London and Brussels and Washington, you know, they kind of listened to me. They believed that I was telling the truth, but no one really sort of saw the implications. But this is a country that puts dead people on trial, where the president steals money. And people, and they lie, and they publicly lie, and they publicly lie in the face of evidence to the contrary. And all of a sudden, that's what they're doing on a global scale.
Bill Browder remains on a mission to achieve justice, a mission that has enjoyed scant success, frankly, in Russia itself, and even in this country as well. I know the State Department in America has moved a little bit faster than perhaps our own Foreign Office has on this issue.
Yeah, so Sergei was killed in Russia in 2009. We had huge evidence of torture and murder. This was not speculation. This was not hearsay. This was documented evidence that he was tortured and murdered. The Russians refused to give us justice, and so we said, let's get justice in the West. And so we started to say, well, what kind of justice can we get in the West? And this particular crime of killing Sergei Magnitsky was about money. These guys stole a lot of money from their country. They stole $230 million of taxes from their own country. He exposed them. He was killed. And the guys who steal this kind of money, they don't like to keep it in Russia because it's not safe in Russia for the same reason that it was so easy for them to steal it from their government. It could be stolen from them. So they like to go to the West. They'd like to come to London, to south of France, to New York City. They'd like to put their kids in boarding school and all this kind of stuff. And so we said to ourselves, well, the one kind of justice we can get in the West is cutting off the West, making it so they can't spend their money, that their money gets frozen, and they can't travel.
This is another parallel, then, with the big picture at the moment with regard to sanctions and trying to do something that would harm the people in charge in Russia, and you hit them in the wallet.
Well, this is the one thing that we can do, which is, unlike the Soviet era, these guys, we're in a globalized world where you have a bunch of kleptocrats that like to travel to the West, that they love it. They don't like being in Russia. They like to steal in Russia, and then they like to party in the West. And it took a while, but I was able to get the United States government to pass something named after my murdered lawyer. His name was Sergei Magnitsky, and it was called the Magnitsky Act. The United States Congress passed the Magnitsky Act. The president signed it, and which means that the people who killed him and people who do other similar gross human rights abuses can't travel to America, will have their assets frozen in America. And what's so remarkable is that Britain has refused to do it. And I'm a British citizen. My voice might betray it, but I'm a British citizen. I've been living here for 25 years. And Britain is the first port of call. My government is the first port of call. A lawyer working for a British company was tortured to death. And the British government, up until now, have refused to impose any sanctions. The people who killed Sergei Magnitsky can freely travel to Britain. They can spend their money in Britain. And the government refuses to do anything to stop them.
These are people who are banned from spending that money in America.
So why is it that America doesn't allow them and Britain does? Because Britain, our leaders, currently don't want to upset Russia. The current leaders of this country have made a decision, which is that it's better to look the other way and allow really evil, terrible criminals come here because they're spending money. And so I'm saying, what is so special about this particular group of torturers and murderers that we have to give up our principles and allow them into this country?
You see it that starkly. There is a simple, pragmatic trade-off between morality and material wealth that our leaders are making on behalf of their friends and their cronies.
Well, and so, for example, there is this terrible, horrible assassination using nuclear materials of Alexander Litvinenko.
Yes.
And the Home Secretary intervened in the inquest and said, we don't want this inquest to go forward because getting to the truth of an assassination might mess up business with Russia. I mean, that's just unbelievably immoral and shocking.
Do you fear for your safety?
Of course I do. How could I not? I'm here. I am talking on your show about money laundering, corruption, Putin, Russia. These people have threatened me on a number of occasions. They made death threats and by email, by text message, and all sorts all sorts of different ways, and maybe one day they'll get me. But I'm not going to live my life cowed and in fear. I can't allow that to happen when they've horrifically murdered my lawyer, who was just trying to uncover the truth.
So the Americans were prepared to act against these individuals to hit them in the pocket. But as you keep reminding us, and you'll forgive me for returning to this, because I am deeply shocked by it, that the British establishment won't.
The British government, the current leaders of the British government, are refusing to ban the people who killed Sergei Magnitsky from coming into the country.
In the way that the American government has.
The American government has banned them. The British government hasn't. These torturers and murderers are so special, they're allowed to come here.
Which leads us, I suppose, to the bigger picture at the moment, or at least to the international stage, and the question of why Vladimir Putin acts with such apparent disregard for the West and can ride roughshod into sovereign territory and plant his troops on the ground. The answer could well be the same, certainly in the case of London, the prospect of us doing anything to curtail his ambitions is to him laughable because of all the money that his friends are spending here.
Well, he has two ways of going about things. He's a former KGB officer, and so basically his whole relationship with any outside human being is either through bribery or terror. And so what he's done is he's going around terrorizing those he can't bribe, and then happily bribing those who he can. And he's effectively bribed Britain, and as a result of that, this country is effectively sacrificing European security. If Putin has not stopped at eastern Ukraine, he's going to start taking other territories.
What's his motivation there? I mean, there are obvious answers to that, prestige and this sort of the bear, the Russian bear being revivified by Putin's imperialist ambitions. But why do you think he's doing this now, with your insights and perspective?
Well, I know exactly the kind of man he is, and I know what he's worried about. First and foremost, he's a kleptocrat. Putin has stolen more money than you and I could ever possibly imagine. And there was a growing protest movement in Moscow that even when it was when the authorities were trying to squelch it out, the people who were most popular in this opposition movement were people who were complaining about him stealing all this money, about all the corruption that was ruining their lives. His approval ratings went up 10 points the moment after he took Crimea. And he's gotten all the Russians worked up into a nationalist frenzy, and they've all forgotten how angry they are about his corruption. And that's what this is about. And if you
classic distraction tactic.
And if you believe me about that, and that's what it is,
yes.
If you believe me about that, then it means he can't stop. He's got to keep going. He's got to do this on and on and on to keep people distracted. And that's what's probably going to happen. And that's where the big risk is, because he's just going to keep on taking territory and doing all these, playing all these games and lying and yes, hurting people all over in neighboring countries.
And yet, people will point out there was a plebiscite of sorts on the ground in Crimea. There are Russian-speaking people in eastern Ukraine who want to restore their loyalties to Moscow. There is a narrative that paints the Ukrainian regime change as Western-sponsored, and there is a narrative that paints the people in eastern Crimea Eastern Ukraine and Crimea as driving the return to Moscow.
Well, those are the same people that prosecuted Sergei Magnitsky posthumously. I mean, you have the Crimea, you send in 20,000 troops pointing guns at everybody, and then you have your own naval base there, and then you organize a plebiscite where you can't vote against it, and you probably cheat. And then you tell everybody that this was democratically...
And it's boycotted by your opponents anyway.
Right. And so, that's a complete, utter bunch of nonsense. And then going into eastern Ukraine, Russia sends in their own special agents and troops, and they found them. They found numerous Russian troops that are all heavily armed with Russian military equipment. And they're saying somehow that this is like... local activists is complete and utter nonsense, and it's been proven forensically by anybody looking at it that's just one big lie. And then as far as Kiev goes and the Maidan revolution, and the people in Ukraine wanted one thing, which is that they look to the east and they say the life expectancy is 20 years less than looking to the west. And so they're saying, what do we want to do? Live longer or live shorter? What do we want to do? Have freedoms or not have freedoms? And so most people said, we'd rather have like normal European lives instead of some kind of oppressive lives where we end up dying at the age of 58.
But of course he can't countenance that, because it brings potential disaster closer to his doorstep.
Right. So what does he do? He comes up with this crazy narrative, and this is an exact replica of what Hitler did in the 1930s, protecting Russian nationals in different countries. What is he going to do? Come and invade Knightsbridge now? There's a lot of Russians in Knightsbridge. It's a complete myth that any of these people want any help from Russia.
And next, then, under your analysis, will be another effective invasion, another de facto invasion of another former Soviet territory.
Yeah, so they'll look at Moldova. Maybe they'll even start looking at the Baltics. And the thing is that sooner or later, it's going to affect our interests in a much more profound way than it does right now.
If we'd spoken 6 months ago, would you have thought that Crimea would be a tipping point for the British government to wake up to what you are saying, that the invasion of Crimea, the invasion of eastern Ukraine, that these would be tipping points?
Well, I mean, in modern Europe, to have a country redraw the borders using force is something that we haven't dealt with in any of our generations. And so that had to be a tipping point. Putin kept on pushing and pushing, and this is the point where everybody says, oh, my God, this guy is really serious. And I can tell you that the people who are currently running this country and other countries are looking at this thing, and they're in a state of raw panic, because none of these people, every current world leader has never dealt with a foreign policy crisis like the one we have right now, where we could truly end up in a world war the way Vladimir Putin is behaving.
William Browder in conversation with James O'Brien of Britain's LBC Radio. And that ends this special edition of FSN Reports. For everyone with feature story news every